Good afternoon, family. My name is Doug, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Gay Men and Women Together group in San Jose, California, and welcome to the 2010 International Convention. And happy birthday, Alcoholics Anonymous, 75 years. I'm sober through God's grace today, and it's an absolute privilege to have been able to be one of those few people that got a loving invitation from our General Service Office to be able to chair this meeting with you today. If we may, let's start off with a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries over the past 75 years. As I said, this workshop is titled Fearless in Searching, and we have three great speakers from different parts of the country to come up and share their experience, strength, and hope with you today. And today is the first time I've gotten to meet all three of our speakers, and I think you're in for a treat. And I'd like to first introduce you to Jill M. from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
My name is Jill McDonald. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I'm a member of the Parkway West group. And we're alive and well. We're not a glum lot. Geez, this is such an honor. You know, I know there's been some people a part of this happening for me, and I'm indebted to Mary Lou and Rick Walker. I'd like to thank you, and God has been so good to me. You know, it's only by the grace of God that I stand here today. My sobriety date's December 5th, 1983. I come in a room. I come in the rooms when I was 17, and boy, I just think back. I could just picture myself sitting there teetering. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go? You know, because I wasn't married five times at that point. You know, I couldn't relate to that. And by the grace of God, I wasn't in jail, you know. But I've seen a lot of psychiatrists, psychologists. My rehab was St. Francis Rehab in Pittsburgh. And there was people that were so instrumental in my sobriety and me standing here. There was a guy, Joe Newport, when I was in rehab, you know, he said, give yourself a chance, kid. And, you know, he says, give yourself 90 days. If you don't think you're an alcoholic, go drink. And I was like, wow, that made so much sense. And so after, I don't know if I quite made it 90 days, I decided to drink. But it was so subtle how it happened because, you know, rehabs, they tell you, you know, don't wear any of the AC/DC shirts or anything with a leaf on it or anything like that. You know, don't hang around with your old friends. I didn't. I met a new friend, you know, and I got a beer, you know. And I wasn't even like 50 yards away from my house and I drank his beer. Now I'm going to AA meetings and doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, you know, but I'm not being honest. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't share that plan with my sponsor. And when I, you know, had that beer and instant guilt, instant everything, and then a week later, drinking beer, smoking left-handed cigarettes, and then the last time, I'm in a blackout. And when I come to, I knew, not just in my head. Because, see, I always thought, you know, and was pretty proud about being an alcoholic and how much I can consume. But it went from my head to my heart, and that made such a difference in my program. Didn't jump into the steps or anything like that, didn't get on that bandwagon. I was just going to meetings, and I wasn't honest with anybody else either, you know, about me going back out and drinking, and I don't recommend that for anybody, really. It was horrid. I almost had myself convinced that I had to drink again, you know, like I have that kind of power. you know, so I could tell people that I drank. You know, that was my crazy thinking, you know. I did with every person that doesn't work a program. I found a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And talk about these instincts we got, you know, and how they run wild, you know, and all this and that. My husband was helping me. He wasn't my husband quite yet, you know. Was part of my plan anyway. But he was working with me in the steps, you know, at emotional sobriety, you know, teaching me a little bit about the steps. Because where I come from, there wasn't a whole lot of women that were in the steps. And I was feeling like that connection, you know. And we got together. And a lot of my old-timer friends weren't real thrilled with the idea. But we were going to be different. And I remember going to Cook's Forest. And I struggled with God big time. And I went to Cook's Forest. And there was a girl that, you know, I was running with. And she was sharing with me all her woes and stuff that she was going through. And she got called up to Cook's Forest Conference and started talking about her God. And I had no really belief until then, you know. But I knew a little bit about her story. And I got some faith, you know, from her, from sharing with her. And come back from Cook's Forest, and I wanted what you people had, you know. And I started doing my fourth step, and I did the fourth step just like it is in the big book, the first three columns, and that's all I did. And I stayed sober like that for a while. It was a little bit of a rocky road. Me and my husband decided to make house. You know, I went to college, you know, for a week. I did the Evelyn Woods course. And my people were not very happy about all this, but you know, I didn't know. You know, I was so you know, the security instinct. You know, I was so scared. You know, fear ran my life when I was drinking, and it ran it when I got sober. You know, I just put down a drink. You know, I didn't do anything that anybody suggested me to do thereafter. You know, and the kind of sponsors I picked, I didn't pick the ones that were going to tell me the truth. I stayed away from them like the plague. You know, and the sponsors that I did have, you know, they sort of coincided my BS, you know, and I stayed sober like that for a long time. And, you know, I thought I was doing good because I was going to meetings and I was, you know, a little bit active at my home group, not very much. But, you know, I truly thought I was doing good. I had no idea. You know, I started becoming a workaholic and working 7 days a week. You know, I just, instead of plugging myself into the steps and the higher power and stuff, I plugged myself into working, you know. And I was going to one meeting a week, and I wasn't feeling like I fit in too much. I can remember sitting down at this meeting we had back home, a Carnegie meeting, and just sitting there and looking around at all these people one night, and I did not feel a part of. And these are my people. You know, and I was a long year and a half of torture with that. You know, I seek every other method, like, you know, Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book, you know, trying to think that that was my answer and staying sober. And, you know, it wasn't until I realized after time, and I had a lot of people that loved me, but you know what, love won't keep you sober. You know, my parents loved me, my grandparents, you know, my uncles, everybody loved me, you know, but that didn't keep me sober. Then I guess it got worse. I start getting honest with myself. You know, I started, you know, like my husband and this other, because we had gotten married by the time, and you want to talk about a marriage made in heaven, you know, when you ain't working your steps, you know. And then I like, you know, in the big book, how it talks about the grass and the brainstorming ain't for us. Well, that's how I lived. That's like a garbage disposal. Rah, rah, rah. That's all I sounded like, you know. I sell plumbing material. But anyhow, I just went, you know, along in life like that for like a long time. And I realized I wasn't praying. I wasn't working with people. I wasn't going to meetings and stuff like I should. 13 years sober, me and my husband got a separation. And it was like somebody pulled a carpet right out from underneath my feet. It talks about it in the big book, the three pertinent ideas, no human power can relieve our alcoholism. Well, he became my higher power in sobriety. And I talk about this because I work with a lot of women, you know, and it seems like it's a very common trait. You know, I wasn't going to meetings unless he was going to meetings and all that stuff. But anyhow, God intervened in my life like there was no tomorrow. Because I tell you what, I was so, like, I was whacked out, but I wanted to check out, you know. And I got a new sponsor. My sponsor, Diane, I love her to death because she told me the truth. She got me into the steps. She got me looking at myself. You know, because all my life, that's all I ever did was blame everybody for my stuff, you know. And she just told me the truth, you know, and I believe that saved my life. And she also told me, get with the women, you know, get sponsoring people and doing a deal. And that's what I started doing. And my God, my life turned around so much, I can't even believe it. I mean, I was so full of fear. I would not leave my house at one point, you know. And I wouldn't go away on weekends together unless my husband was there. But it ain't like anything like that today. You know, I have a full life, and I thank God for the steps. You know, God has been so gracious to me, and I know it's only by the grace of God that I stand here today, because I did almost everything wrong you could possibly do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love working the steps with my girls because I learn stuff. There's stuff that they share with me that, geez, I never even thought about, you know. And I believe in big book studies. We have a big book study at our group. We've had big book studies at our houses, and it has saved my butt. And, you know, I'm proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, 75 years, you know, and it's awesome. I just want to thank everybody. Thank all my people for supporting me here today. I love you guys all and girls, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Jill. Really appreciate that. I was able to identify a lot with what you were talking about there and the importance of having that home group. And I absolutely love mine. Our next speaker comes to us from Shepherd, Montana, Virginia R.
Oh, my gosh. My name is Virginia, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 14th of 1991. I got sober a little later in life. I was 39 years old when I got sober. So just to make it easy for you, 39 and 19 years of sobriety is 58. So that's how old I am. I'm a late bloomer, kind of. My home group is the recovery group of Billings, Montana. And they're not as noisy as the people from Pennsylvania. But they're here. There are also the other 73 people that live in Montana are here, too. We all came. As you know, it was attested here that so your home group is supposed to be here to support you, you know. And I would like to say that my home group, half of them came to try to make me cry, and the other half came to tell you that I'm lying. So I have to be really careful when I'm up here. My sponsor is Terry H. She's from Billings, Montana. Terry, she's been my sponsor for 10 years. She is the most wonderful sponsor in the world. She is beautiful, and she's single. Yeah. I want to thank my delegate for submitting my name. I don't know if she got here. She was at the delegate's luncheon. But she submitted my name to speak. And I want to say about her that she is the best delegate in the world. She is beautiful, and she's single. Yeah. So Okay. Well, I got the letter in the mail saying that I was supposed to speak, and I opened it up, and it said my topic was fearless and searching. And I thought, somebody sent me the wrong letter. This can't possibly be my topic. And besides that, it's a typo, because it's supposed to be fearless, searching and fearless. And I got fearless and searching. And so I'm trying to figure this all out. And what am I supposed to talk about? And it takes a lot to kind of get my act together. So I was, the day before yesterday morning, I was kind of starting to think about what I might say. And because I want to give a good talk, you know, I want to be funny and spiritual and just all over it, you know. And so I started thinking about it, and then, you know, I'm enjoying myself at the convention. It's lots of fun, and I'm meeting people. And so then this morning I'm going out for a run, and I said, okay, this is it. I'm going to really think about what I'm going to say now. This is absolutely it. And so I get out there, and I ran a few minutes, and then God sent this angel to me named Bridget from Connecticut, and I don't know if she's here, but she ran with me. And you know what? I didn't have to think about myself at all. She's 5 years sober, and she was just a breath of fresh air. And actually, as we got started running, we were talking about some stuff, and one of the things she mentioned was that she's a little bit afraid to go back in and go to school and get back in her profession. And I thought, and I immediately responded by saying, well, you know, every day when you leave the house, you take God with you. You know, no reason to be fearful. And that's my old stuff, because at the end of, it took me, first of all, it took me a little while to get sober. I wasn't an overnight miracle. And at the end of it, I was hanging with people with guns. And I was in an apartment with the windows broken out. And that was in the middle of winter, and it was cold. And I just didn't have much left in my life. And but I'll tell you what, I was not scared of anything. And I would stand up to anybody, and I would make my point that, you know, you guys out there on the streets weren't going to get to me because I'm smarter, I'm faster, and I can completely outdo you. You know, I've got a better plan. And so I wasn't afraid, you know, and that's kind of my theme throughout my life. I have been totally fearless and proud to admit it. And, you know, and still today, I love doing scary stuff. You know, it's lots of fun. I have a ski buddy or two over here, and I will follow anybody down any mountain. And I love that, you know, and it's just has to do with proving a point. You know, I'm not afraid, and nothing's going to scare me, and I'm going to do it, you know. And I can get over my head sometimes. You know, I'm crashing into trees and falling into snowbanks, but it's great. You know, I'm not scared, at least. And so what I've seen happen now, though, is that when I need to tell the truth to another person, when I need to allow God to come in my life and help me become a better person, I am scared to death. You know, I'm scared to death. I've done several fourth steps, and each one has become progressively more honest, you know, because my first one, I had a sponsor that was just delightful. Her solution to stopping drinking was to take a bubble bath and light a candle. That doesn't work for an alcoholic like me. I need some substance, you know. If I could have taken a bubble bath, I would have done that a long time ago. And in those days, my personal hygiene was not top on my list anyway, so. So, So she offered me that, you know, and during the fourth step that I wrote for her, it was just a story of my life. And then when I shared it with her, it took a couple days because I like to talk, and poor thing sat there and listened to the whole thing. But I never once told her anything about the things that I was embarrassed about or ashamed of or those secrets that kept me sick. And, you know, I've been in treatment a lot, so I know that you're only as sick as the secrets you keep. And I thought, I'm never going to get well because I cannot tell the truth. You know, I can't share with another person what's really inside me. And I am just too intimidated by all that. So over the years, I've lived in a couple different places in sobriety, and I see some of my friends from Illinois back there, Northern Illinois. And I've gotten to be a couple different places in sobriety, and I've had different sponsors. When I got sober, it was Minnesota, and my sponsor told me, I stayed there 3.5 years, and she said, it was time for me to leave, and she said, you have to get a sponsor that you can meet with face-to-face. That's absolutely mandatory for you. And so I did that, but I'd done a fifth step with her, and I'd gotten a little more honest because she was a real alcoholic and a really amazing person, and I knew that I could trust her. And then I got to Illinois, I had to get another sponsor, and I got active in service, and I got a service sponsor, and she lived out of town, but she was a lady that had been sober a long time and full of grace and dignity and just an amazing person. And she had me do a fourth step, but you know what? I still couldn't come clean with everything because I thought, this is not the kind of person that has lived the life that I've lived, you know. I've always got an excuse. And so then I moved to Montana, and I came upon this gal that I immediately upon moving to Montana, I didn't know anybody. Why would I? You know, and I was sober 9 years. And I moved to Montana, and I went to the Christmas party. And that was like the day after I got there. And so I see this little gal, and she's with somebody that I know is an alcoholic that I met earlier, her husband. And I said, oh, my God, what a cute little Al-Anon girl. Well, I came to find out that my soon-to-be sponsor was a scooter trash, a biker chick. And she's cleaned up really well. And so So what I've learned from her is that I've learned a lot about trusting, and I have learned a lot about being honest, and I have learned that that if I tell her the truth, she will love me still no matter what. And that's what I try to do with the women I sponsor. And it's been interesting over the years of my sobriety because I used to be really great in AA meetings, but a holy terror at work. Just an absolute terror. When I first got sober, the only job I could get was to clean rooms in a hotel, and I did that for a year, and I would be so angry. I'd be throwing chairs out of the rooms and, you know, and screaming at people and cussing at people and, you know, and it was bad. And then eventually I got to go back into my profession, and I'm a registered nurse. I work in the intensive care unit in a hospital in Billings, Montana, and I remained a holy terror. My patients are too needy. My coworkers don't understand me. And the doctors are so stupid. You know, and this is just, I mean, I got to straighten people out, you know. And here I am, somebody who's lost her nursing license, on probation twice and indefinitely suspended once. But, whoa, I know better than you guys. So it took me a while, but after You know, and I didn't realize through this whole time that I have been searching. You know, I had no idea. When I was searching for a plan. I was searching for a way out of trouble, or I was searching for some excitement. And it never occurred to me to search for a spiritual answer. That has not been part of my past. Like many of us, I know, looked all over to find a spiritual solution. I didn't. I didn't think I needed it, you know. And I was pretty independent, and I don't need that kind of stuff. But as I have gone through my sobriety, I have searched for ways to become a better person. And the people surrounding me have helped me so much because I don't have a clue what it's like myself. I have a severe disease of perception, and I bet I'm not the only one in this room. And it hits me at times when I just have no clue, you know. So I'm running rampant, and I'm thinking, okay, I know the problem. The problem is my home group. I don't belong there. I do not belong there. Those guys are nuts. I think it was probably, and the problem is my sponsor, too. The problem is my sponsor a lot. The problem is my job a whole lot, you know. But a few years ago, I think it was maybe 4 years ago, I remember going up to my sponsor after a meeting, and I said, I know what's wrong. And I said, I'm not alcoholic. And you laugh, but you should have seen the look of horror on her face. And she was so scared for me, you know. But I had it figured out. You know, it's not alcoholism. It's something else. And fortunately, because of her love and the love of other people, I've been able to stay in the rooms where I belong. I was going to just mention, I think my delegate walked in a little bit late, so she's once again the best delegate in the world, beautiful and single. And I've had the delight, I'm the area CPC chair for Montana, and I've had the delight of getting to go with her different places as she presents her delegates report, and we've been to you know, the assemblies and such together, I've grown to really respect her for the work she does. And I want to say one thing, though. We were driving about a six-hour trip, and we were leaving from Billings and going to Missoula, Montana, and Carol's driving along. I break her anonymity every chance I get. At least I haven't said her last name yet. But anyway, she's driving along, and we're going. She's got a nice fast car. I love that. I love my other friend Carol's nice fast car. And we're driving along, and all of a sudden she's going, whoa, she's eating a plum. She goes, whoa, this deer runs in front of us. And she slams on the brake, chokes on the plum. But fortunately, she recognizes that I'm a medical professional, and I can help her. So I would like to say that I can steer the car and do CPR with one hand, but that's not exactly what happened. But anyway, we both survived. Throughout my sobriety, as I've said, I've had to become a little more searching and fearless. It hasn't all been the fourth step. My sponsor reminds me frequently about when I started making my amends. And I was writing my amends letters, and obviously was not searching for my part in everything, because I would write a letter like this. It would say, Dear Robert, I am so sorry because I'm thinking it's possible that at some point in the distant past, I might have caused you some harm. I just couldn't see that, yeah, I did cause you harm, and I caused a lot of people around me harm. So I'd bring these letters every week to my sponsor. I'd have 5 letters or something like that. And I'd bring them, and she'd be getting out her red pen. Bam, bam, bam. And so I soon learned that I was going to have to be a little bit more, search a little bit more inside me for my character defects, become a little bit more fearless, and actually send those letters and look for the people. And, you know, though this is a little bit more about the fourth step, I will say that I have sent my amends letters, and I have tried to reach the people that I have harmed, and God has helped me do that. I am not the kind of person that will face anything if I'm wrong. I know I'm right, and why should I try to look at my part? Because I'm right. And it got to the point where I was staying sick. And so I have been able to write my amends letters. And I'll tell you one little story about how God works in my life. There was a person in another state that I'd harmed while being sober, and a little town. And I she was a coworker, and I got her name, and she lived in this tiny little town of about 600 people, and so I just put the address, the town on it, you know, and her name. And I said, man, I hate to send this letter because I was really nasty to her, really nasty, and I hate to mail this thing and hear the consequences, like, you know, like, what can I do to right this wrong? I was not a bit interested in that. And I sent the letter, and a couple weeks later, I got a return letter. And it had her name and the little town she was from. And it said, Dear Virginia, I do not know who you are. But I just want to tell you something. You have touched my entire family. Our father was a chronic alcoholic, and he died never being able to get sober. And our opinion of alcoholics was based on him. And you sent this letter, and you're recovering, and we didn't even know that something like that was possible. And you mentioned that you were doing it through Alcoholics Anonymous. And we are just so excited and happy, and you have changed our lives. And, that's something. So I just want to say that by working the steps and having a God and being honest with the sponsor, even a liar like me can sometimes get to tell the truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Next, I have the privilege of introducing you to Ross H. from Lawton, Oklahoma.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ross, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober today by the grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is June 17, 1973. Thank you. Thank you. That means I haven't had a drink of alcohol, taken any unprescribed mind-sedating or tranquilizing pills, I used any form of drugs for 37 years and 15 days. A true miracle of healing that's only going to continue to be my miracle if, like the Gaunt Prospector says in the book, if I mind it for the rest of my life and I insist on giving away the entire product. Strenuous work one alcoholic with another is vital to our permanent recovery. You all know that. I know that. Look around this room. Just everybody kind of look to your right and your left. And look in front of you. Look behind you. Something, isn't it? What you're looking at is another miracle. Another miracle of healing. Every one of us. God bless it. Amen. Boy. Our combined recovery in this room proves that. Proves that the age of miracles is not dead. So how y'all doing? Everybody having a good time in San Antonio? Isn't it great? What a wonderful deal. So searching and fearless is the topic of this talk. And like we got in the mail, it's a thread that must be woven throughout not just this talk, but my life, if I'm going to expect my miracles to continue. Step 4 says that we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Searching and fearless. What is fear and how can I turn fear into fearless? I can't be fearless or overcome fear in my life without God's help. I love Bill's words in the book, King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settling down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding and companionship and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Then Bill goes on to say, unhappy drinkers who read this understand. I understand fear. I know you understand fear. And when I came into AA, I really didn't understand what fearless was, but I certainly understood what fear was. I was born into an alcoholic family. I was the second of 8 children. Dad's drinking continued to worsen through my early years up until my age of 13 when my dad sobered up for the last time in 1963. He had 3 sober years in AA when he died. Dad left Mom and these 8 kids from age 6 to age 17, penniless. I started my serious drinking when I was 16 and really drank alcoholically till I was 23. So I'm a product of the 60s, and like we children of the 60s say, if you can remember the 60s, you really weren't there. Anybody remember that? So I did my time with all forms of drugs. I found myself one time sitting on a mountaintop in Oklahoma. There was a little mountaintop, and this is not a drug story. I was really a whiskey man and a beer man, more than the drug deal. But, you know, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has some sort of a suicide story. So I'm going to give you a little Reader's Digest version of mine. Anyway, I was on this mountain. We call it Mount Scott in Lawton, Oklahoma, in the Wichita Mountains. And I was up there, and I had a quart of whiskey, another quart of vodka, and a case of beer. And I had a knife, and I was going to cut my wrist. And so I was facing east. I'm not sure why I was facing east. And anyway, so I started drinking. I felt the world was piling up on me. My dreams of being a pro football player were shattered through several knee operations in college football. I married my pregnant wife to try to keep her from aborting our child. That was really a great way to start a marriage, by the way. If you abort that kid, I'm going to beat you with a broomstick. Anyway, things weren't going too well for me. Right before oblivion came over me, I slashed my wrist. Stuck it out the window, pumped it good, blood flowing everywhere, and I cried out, God, forgive me and have mercy on me. very dramatically due to the blood loss that I had and all the alcohol I'd finished off, I finally passed out. My last thought right before I passed out was, well, it's finally over. The battle's over for me. Anyway, as you can tell, I woke up. I awakened with the sun coming up over the horizon with the worst headache you can ever imagine. And an old stray dog was licking my arm that was hanging out of the window, licking that blood off my arm. Anyway, so I got in my car. Turned my car on and drove back down the mountain and went over to old Doc Angus's house. He was another good alcoholic friend of my dad's. And it was Sunday morning. And so he took me down to his office and he cussed me all the way down the office, telling me how stupid I was. And you got all these reasons to live. You got this baby. You got this. You got that. And here you are. You're just stupid. Well, while he was doing that, while he was stitching up my wrist, the four horsemen appeared in my life for the very first time. The terror, the bewilderment, the frustration, the despair, and this overwhelming sense of fear set in on me. It was only when I drank alcohol that the horsemen left. Unbelievable. When I quit drinking, the horsemen appeared again. Started drinking, they left. So I've always said that I really didn't have a drinking problem. I had a drinking answer. Because when I wasn't drinking is when I was having problems. I've had 17 different suicides in my family. Now, that's a large family, but of 100 people with brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and cousins, first and second, maybe more than 100. But there's been 17 of my family members have committed suicide. And every one of them were alcoholic or drug dependent. Every one of them that did that. The book says they couldn't face the reality of their existence. Without help, it is too much for us. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. My family never heard that part, never made it to where we are today. Fearless appears again and again throughout our book. But this was my first recollection in AA of the word fearless. Fearless and thorough from the very start. So how do I turn fear into fearless? Again, without help for this alcoholic, it's too much. So I got to follow Bill's instructions in that book, word for word. The book says on page 53, when we became alcoholics crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? That's what the book says, word for word. My choice 37 years ago was that God is everything. Thank God. Then came my sponsor, Tom Grafton, and he took me through the steps and taught me about the miracle of surrender. Tom taught me and 100 other people that he sponsors, including my buddy Ian that's here from Winnipeg today. He taught me about the first 9 steps, and he called them surrender steps. He told me that once we searching and fearlessly crack through the obsessed ego, we are on the road to recovery. Bill calls them the obsessions of the mind which cause us to drink. Grafton's sponsor was a guy from California that everybody knows and remembers, Chuck C. He referred in his book, A New Pair of Glasses, to the obsessions of the mind as the little children of the ego. The children of the ego are remorse, guilt, shame, lack of trust, contempt, anger, rage, resentment, envy, jealousy, greed, lust, sloth, panic, depression, and finally fear. Did I leave any out, Ian? I don't want Ian to go back to say, Tom forgot some of the children. Or Ross forgot some of the children, Tom. Anyway, Tom went on to teach me that when we do the first 9 surrender steps, and Bill Wilson also says, when we carefully follow directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit, capital S, into us. So the children of the ego are replaced with the children of the Spirit of God. The power flows into us, and the miracle happens. The power flows into us, and the miracle happens. What a great bunch of miracles I'm getting to talk to today. As a result, all is a result of surrender. Grafton reminded me what our old friend Harry Thibault says, surrender is the complete and utter abnegation of self. Bill used words like abandon yourself without reservation. Total and complete surrender has always been the ticket for me, but I got to do it daily. So what do you surrender on a daily basis? Tom tells me it's always the same thing, self. Surrender self. I just love what the book says. Once we surrender, the battle is over and life begins. Many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives. They do present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Dr. Carl Gustav Jung referred to it as union with God. What a powerful statement. We've all read that about Dr. Jung and that union with God deal. Again, I've experienced many miracles in my life. Sponsor Tom calls it the law of compensation. He always reminded me of what you give good to life is what you get back. If you give a little bit of good back, good, you get a little bit back. But if you give a lot of good, you get a lot back. I don't know whether that's Grafton's law, but he said it was, so it's good enough for me. Bill says to redouble your efforts. So when I am searching and fearlessly and continuously doing the steps over and over, good things happen to me. It reminds me of a story of that hopeless, helpless old alcoholic down in South Texas. Might have been South Oklahoma City. I don't know. Could have been. Anyway, this guy couldn't read or write. He never had a job, so his job was drinking full time. This is kind of a story about how God worked for him. He came to Alcoholics Anonymous, got a sponsor, started doing the steps. The obsessed ego disappears, and he starts feeling better. His sponsor suggested that it was time for him to go get a job and told him to go to Main Street in his town and start knocking on every door on Main Street till he found a job. So he did. He'd knock on the door, and as soon as he told them that he couldn't read or write or fill out an employment application, they wouldn't hire him. Knocked on every door. Well, at the end of the block, down on the far end of that town, there was a brothel. Can you imagine? Yay! So he went up to the door and he knocked on the door. The madam comes to the door. And he says, is there anything you've got that I could do for work, earn some money? And she says, yeah, you know, I do need a bookkeeper. He thought, well, I can't read or write. Well, she did tell him that she knew a guy across town that had a hardware store, and if he'd go ask for a job over there, he might get a job. And he did, and the guy hired him. And next thing you know, that guy falls in love with this new employee. And so the story goes, he ends up selling the hardware store to the new guy. Well, then takes that hardware store and starts opening more stores. He ends up with 100 stores inside of 15 years. And so anyway, a New York syndicate came down to try to buy those stores from him. And they sent him a letter first and didn't respond to the letter. Sent him another letter, still didn't respond to the letter. And sent a final letter, and the offers were $10 million, $15 million. The final letter was a $35 million offer for all these 100 stores plus a earnest money contract inside of it. Still didn't answer. So he goes down to see him. New Yorker goes down and calls on the guy, and he said, I sent you all these letters. What's the deal? He said, well, I never learned to read or write, so I didn't know what to do about it. My gosh, he said, you know what? If you'd have just learned to read or write, what do you think you would have done in this business? How much could you have done? He thought to himself, you know, if I'd have learned to read or write, I'd have had to be a bookkeeper in a brothel. See, the power of God runs deep. I've had many miracles in my life. I got to watch my dad get sober. I got sober myself. I got to watch two of my children get sober. My oldest son, Brett, got sober. He was a big-time football player. He got a scholarship offer to Notre Dame. Played in every game as a freshman. Started half the games as a sophomore. Then he gets kicked out. Never saw him take a drink, but he gets kicked out of Notre Dame. He bombs around at OU, Auburn, ends up at TCU, bombs out of there, and comes back home. Goes to work at the state hospital in Norman, and his job is to carry new alcoholics to meetings. So he's sitting in a meeting and starts listening. Well, and I never saw this kid take a drink. I thought he was just crazy. I didn't think he was an alcoholic. So he calls me 90 days later. He says, Dad, I need to come and talk to you. What about? Well, I just need to come down. So he drove down to my town, 70 miles away. And he did a night step with me. And he made amends with me. That was a miracle. First, it was a miracle he got sober. Well, that kid's going to have 15 years of sobriety on July the 5th. And I'm so excited for him. Then my son, Eric. I'll try to be brief with this one. My son, Eric, he's out in California. Simi Valley, California, and he's a computer nerd, and he graduated from high school, when he was 15 years old, and National Merit Scholar, and ends up going to OU, leaves after 1 year, got 60 hours A after a spring, a fall, and a summer school, goes out and starts a company out in California, doing great, ends up with a Z06 vet, and big house on the golf course, and one night he got bad drunk at a party, and he never has. I've never even known him to hardly take a drink. He wrapped his Corvette around a tree going 120 miles an hour, and I get a call in the middle of the night, say, your son's still alive, but you ought to come on out. So I went out there and got there after he had his first surgery, and it was in, can't remember the name of the town there, down by Los Angeles. Anyway, so goes through his first surgery, and I'm talking to him. He's somewhat coherent, and he's broken all the fingers in his hand. Everything on his body's mangled, but he's moving his fingers, and he's got the morphine pump, and he's figured out how to open the door, and he's punching the buttons going up and down, and he's figuring out how he can have more dope or less dope. And, you know, my church family, my AA family, my family, everybody back home's praying for him. Well, the next day, I'm sitting there talking to him, and I said, son, you know, you're going to make it through it. He said, yeah, I know I'm going to make it through it, Dad. He said, I figured out how to take myself out last night with that morphine pump. But he said, God told me that I had a purpose. I'm not sure what the purpose is, but I'm supposed to live. That's another miracle that happened in my life. Just unbelievable. Finally, my baby, Stephen. Stephen had a had a DUI when he was 17 years old. And then lost his driver's license. Doesn't go to treatment. Kind of goes underground. Goes into meth business. Starts putting a needle in his arm. And all the things that meth addicts do. And drinking whiskey, just full blown. Anyway, so that kid, 4.5 years ago, after a couple of different treatment centers, gets sober. When he was arrested, he didn't get a drug charge. And that was a miracle. That was another miracle. When he was arrested, he came into the courtroom, shackled. It was the dadgummit scene I'd ever seen. He weighed 133 pounds, and normally he's 275 and 6'5". And he was a couple of weeks from being dead. So anyway, he goes to the treatment center, halfway house, the Oxford house, starts working. Then I take him to college, and so he graduated from college this spring, 4.5 years later, and. Yeah. Now the rest of the story. With a 3.6 grade average, doing great. And so I heard the day of my birthday that Stephen went back out. Devastated me. Devastated me. You know, it's one thing to your friends in AA, that's devastation enough if they spit the bit. But when your kid spits it, it'll break your heart. Thank God for guys like Dorsey to talk me through that the other day. But the miracle of this thing, you know, I was in the office and I called him on the phone. He said, "Dad, I'm not an alcoholic." He said, "I'm a meth addict. I can drink normal." Anybody ever hear that? And I said, "Well, good luck, son." I said, "I love you. Always am going to love you. You're always welcome to come stop by for dinner. But till you get it figured out, I'm basically have to cut you out of my life because I can't take the pain and the devastation anymore. So you're done. Hope you get well." And so an hour later, so I'm in my office when I'm telling him all this stuff. I shut the doors and get on my knees and I start crying out to God. And guess what? Cliff Gooden walks through the door on my AA birthday. And gets it all straightened up for me. Thank you, Cliff, for doing it that day. Anyway, there's a couple other minor miracles that I've had in my life. But it's time to quit. But I'll just say, close here, what Bill Wilson said in the book. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has, in each case, accomplished the miraculous. Let's look at the record. Bill goes on to say, "Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of thinking and living. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them." What a miracle. What a miracle we are. Where did a searching and fearless attitude take me? It took me headlong into Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. As Bill said to me, I found a release from care, boredom, and worry. My imagination is truly fired. Life finally means something to me at last. Finally, most important, the most satisfactory years of my existence are still ahead. Thus I found the fellowship that I crave, and so will you. Thus I found the fellowship that we all crave. I'm all in on this deal, and so will you. So be searching and fearless and looking for your miracles. The age of miracles is still with us, people. God bless you all.